Now, did you say earlier that we're using our phones a lot when we're in the store and how that can help drive purchase behavior?
Yeah, absolutely. And so one of the things that, it's incumbent upon us. So we're trying to win our share, grow our share, but our retailers are trying to win the occasion. They're trying to grow their occasion. So, take summertime, right? It's a big barbecue time. How do we help them win that occasion or big game? How do we help them win the big game occasion? So we want to do at-pop activities. Like I mentioned, some of the physical displays, the shelf talkers, digital in-store. But how do we drive shoppers to their store, right? Shopper media. So there's general media, and then there's media that drives people to the store. How do we combine those two to tell the retailer when we sit with them, we're trying to explain to them, hey, here's why you should support our products for the big game timeframe, because we're going to drive them to your store with this vehicle. And then once they're in your store, we're going to help you win the occasion and close the deal with these physical or digital elements. So that's where the pre-pop really comes in big time. And the retailers are really linking into that more. They want to know, what am I getting out of this? So generic TV media helps build brands, clearly. Doesn't really help Kroger win the occasion.
So speaking of retailers, I think of, and you correct me if this is not right, I think of it as being a very, very fragmented market, right?
Yes, it is.
And how does that compare to like when you're at Campbell's, right? And you've got Walmart and Kroger and really, really big that you can do things majorly at scale.
Yeah.
How does that change at a Pernod Ricard where you're selling to
yeah
this very fragmented retailer base?
you could win at Campbell's. We could win, just you just named two customers. We could win those and then call it a third, and we'd win the time. We would our share would grow during that forward period. That's not the way it works here. It's much more fragmented. You've got some big dogs, Kroger, Total Wine and More, Albertsons, some Costco, really big. But then you've got this little thing called the indie liquor channel, which is about two-thirds of the business. So, and it's not chains. And that's a unique situation. A lot of it's driven by the old laws, right? And where you can and can't sell liquor. A lot of you can't sell it in grocery stores in many states, things like that. So that's what drove that. That's what kind of makes it fun too. You have it's like you, in soup, if you got the door closed by a couple of the big dogs, oh, what are you gonna do now? Here, oh, okay, these three doors are closed. Well, let's go here. How do we win with these customers? And there's so many great customers out there, so many opportunities to grow share. You just need to find the right partner at the right time, and you can grow share no matter what the big dogs do. But it's always easier when you have the big dogs working with you.
I was going to say, well, one of the things that we talked about kind of start to put a bow on the talking shop part of this. I alluded earlier, I'm a data geek from a lot of syndicated background. I love it. And one of the things that you had shared with me in a prior conversation was not getting too fixated on any one data point and how strategy shouldn't, be changing all that quickly. And you
Yeah.
shouldn't be too enamored with a data point. Could you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the shopper is always evolving, right? I mean, we see it. I mean, just think about, P&G did some great research, cutting edge, first moment of truth, right? It was like 20 years ago. It was cutting edge 20 years ago. And a lot of great things came out of that. But, a lot of that doesn't stand anymore. It's not, you can't say it was debunked because it was right at the time, but things have changed. The shopper has evolved. Last 3 feet is not a thing. It's the last 3 feet. It's like the minute the shopper gets up in the morning to the time they close the deal, that's how many feet they cover during the day. That's the number of feet you need to be talking, not the last three. So the shopper's always evolving. That's the biggest evolution, is their journey, their path has just grown. And so I mentioned earlier about 60% of shoppers knew what they wanted before they walk in the store. Now it's 48. That's 2 years later. On premise, 85% of shoppers don't know what they want when they walk into a restaurant, bar, diner. They do not know what they're looking to drink. So knowing that piece of information, we got to win the menu, at the bar with the bartender, at the table with the table temp. These are all things that just a couple of years ago we didn't see as big trends. Now they are. So if you fixate with the moment of time and then you set your strategy, you're locked into that strategy for at least a few years while the shopper continues to change their habits. So when I say you can't switch your strategy too often, you shouldn't, especially if you get it right, okay? Because strategy takes a lot of time to build, have all the elements you want to support the strategy, including the structure. But if the shopper continues to evolve, and you don't have the right insight, right? Then your strategy doesn't work. So you have to get the right insight. You have to keep an eye on the ball all the time, the ball being the shopper, and make sure that that strategy still supports that insight. So, and it's a challenge, but I do think COVID was a little bit, hopefully, an anomaly. And so we saw way more shopper evolution than we have, you know, at least in my time in the industry. That's not going to be the norm.
Yeah, I think what a lot of people would say about COVID, just to touch on that for a second, is things that were kind of happening, just microwave, boom, happened in a very short, compressed period of time. So most of the trends were kind of already starting to happen, like click and collect,
yeah,
and you're using phones to order and all that kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden it's just like, boom, that became the thing.
Yeah.
But you know, retail media networks, you know, there's just all kinds of new ad tech, martech technology that is going to continue to influence the consumer. And to your point, what was a great idea 3 years ago may need to move because the consumer's moved, the shopper's moved.
Right, exactly. So,
this is great. I obviously geek out a little bit on the category and the shopper stuff, and I think all that's really, really fun. But we also like to tap into our guests' career expertise. And as I've gotten to know you, you're usually I would ask a guest, what would you tell your 28-year-old self? And what was fun talking with you is what you did tell your 24-year-old son.
Yeah.
Just talking career advice, and you know, kind of with the benefit of hindsight, you know, you've had a wonderful career. Sounds like you've really enjoyed your time at all the stops that you've made. But as you're talking to, you know, your 24-year-old son, what are some of the pillars of the advice that you gave him as he's starting to chart his career?
Yeah, I mean, some of it, it's not like I have, I can't sit here and say that I would be a career advisor for a living. I don't think I would do very well. But when your son asks you career advice, you better come up with something good. And so, you know, to me, it's not that complicated. First, it starts out with just working hard. I know that sounds really old school and really boring, but I think it still matters pretty good deal. The other thing is you had a guest on Eric Kershat recently who talked about, he mentioned not everybody has the luxury of finding their passion. Like some people they just need to get a job, right? And so one of the things that I told myself is like, look, I want you to do something that you love. Because if you do, odds are you're going to be better at it. If you're better at it, you're going to be successful. You're going to be happier. You'll make more money. You'll have more opportunities, right? So it starts with finding something that you're passionate about. And that's great. And I truly hold to that. At the same time, there seems to be sometimes this, at least recently, this opinion of, I need to love going to work every single day. That's not realistic. I love my job. I love my company. I love this industry. There's a lot of days I don't love, right? It's called a job. So you need to balance that realistic. Sometimes you got to get out of bed and go make things happen because you're getting paid to do it. Yeah. But if you find yourself that it's a grind and you're getting out of bed and you just don't want to go to work too often, then you need to make a career change. So I told my son, I was like, look, you're a smart kid. You work really hard. You're good at what you do. He seems to have found his passion and he's doing well. And what I've told him is, but career paths, they go up, they go down, they go sideways, right? I mean, I've had lateral moves, right? It's all kinds of things. Be open. Keep making your improving your skill set at your current craft. And if you feel like you're hitting a dead end, have enough other interests and enough of a network that if you want to make a change, you can make that change. And I told him when I was growing up in the industry, that wasn't really as much of an option. You see people making sea changes in their careers pretty late in their careers that you didn't see. I don't know, maybe a lot, but you have different, well, you're in the business, you probably see it more than me. And so
I did it.
Yeah, you did, exactly right. Well, these are things that couldn't have happened years and years ago. So I tell him, focus, work hard, do your job, get really good at it, you know, stay passionate about it. But also don't be myopic, because something might come along that's, you know, better for you or you're better at, and be willing to listen when that opportunity comes.
Yeah. So, Chris, a couple of things. First of all, thank you for listening to the chat that we had with Eric Kershat. He's phenomenal. He's one of my favorites. And I thought that was a very empathetic, compassionate thing that he said about you know, like some people just simply don't have the luxury. And that's a very fair statement. And at the same time, what you're telling your son is quite true. Like if it's something you actually are interested in, and taking your son with the Flyers, like if he's like really loves hockey, loves being around pro sports, like how can you not just naturally have a higher energy level and tend to do better? The other thing, and we talk about this with some of our other HR-oriented guests, is the world's changing very quickly. And kind of the key superpower is being an agile learner and being able to learn something new quickly. Well, if it's on a topic, hammers, like I don't care about hammers, like I'm going to be less interested in trying to stay up on hammers versus what's going on in hockey, which I love. Like I'm super, like I've got my Liverpool pennant back here. Like if I worked at, you know, for Liverpool or the English Premier League or something like that, like you have no problem making me stay current, you know, on what's going on in that because I love it. I'm really interested in it. But I've always felt that way with consumer insights. I just think people are weird. I think that, like, you know, trying to understand how people make decisions is endlessly fascinating.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've always had a strong interest in it. And I think that that's really an important point that you made.
Yeah, I mean, I will geek out on something I'll learn during the day from one of my Shopper Insights partners, and I'll go and tell my wife that night, and she'll be like, okay, you know, really? I mean, no, this is really cool. Look at this. You know, can't you relate to this? You're a shopper, you know? And so I think that's the thing. It's part of this thing is why I love that I've been so lucky to work for some great companies, that all things that people can relate to, right? Soup, soda, wine, spirits, you know, that, you know, selling steel, I've had the chance to move around and do some other stuff, and I'm like, no knock. I mean, sure, they're wonderful companies and great for some people. It just wouldn't have worked for me. I need that. I need to be able to connect personally to something.
Yeah. One of the other things that you had mentioned to me that I think is just phenomenal is the importance of authenticity.
Yeah.
Could you riff on that a little bit?
Yeah. It's funny because I do believe, you know, people will follow the message after they believe in the messenger. And as I mentioned earlier, I had the chance to build out this team, and it's a super great team. And we had to kind of pick the players a bit, if you will, and that was really fun. And if you're authentic, and that is such an overused term these days, because I see people trying to be authentic. If you're trying to be authentic, that means you're not being authentic. That means you're being the opposite of authentic. You're doing something. So, but you just... And if there's something about which you feel like you can't be authentic, you're better off just not even going there. Because I believe people are smart and they can read people very well. Mm. You know, emotional intelligence is probably, well, was an all-time high for a while. I don't know what the pandemic did to it. But I believe that authenticity breeds trust, breeds respect, prevents the emperor has no clothes syndrome. You know, if you're authentic, folks are going to come and tell you, you know what, Chris, I think you got this wrong. And if you don't have people willing to do that with you, then you're going to be wrong an awful lot. Because nothing makes me prouder than when, well, maybe this is a slight exaggeration, but I'm very proud when my team says, Chris, you screwed this up. We think you should do this, this, and this instead. I'm like, wow, I have good people. I'm so lucky, right? Number one. Number two, I have people who aren't afraid to talk to me. So I think authenticity breeds trust, breeds respect. And that comes with, you know, people enjoying being around you, but it also comes with managerial courage. So you don't always want to tell them just what they want to hear. You've got to be able to give them the tough news. And if you do that, it does two things. First of all, it proves that you're authentic. And secondly, you do them a favor. Because I've seen many leaders who are really good people and have the best of intentions. And they've got a lot of friends around them. And they're always friends and they're always high-fiving and backslapping. And then those individuals never improve, they never develop, they never grow. And that doesn't do that individual any favors. Some of the folks that work for me, they've worked for me at several different companies. We've moved around together and we've had some tough conversations over the years during the course of their careers. And they're grateful for those tough conversations. They don't like them at the time, but if you have them and you do them in the right way, you build that bond, you build that trust. And I think others see that. I think that's a key, kind of a cornerstone of leadership.
No, that really speaks to me. I want to jump back on authenticity for a second. One of the things that really occurs to me, Chris, that you're talking about, that may not always be synonymous with, but I think it's highly, highly correlated is vulnerability. And it's the point that you were making, the willingness to say, hey, I think I messed that up. Like, yeah. I didn't do that quite as well, maybe as I could have. And there's something called the vulnerability paradox, which is the thing that we admire the most in people. Like, Chris is so transparent. Like, he just says what's really going on. I love that about him. Is the thing, the paradox is what we admire so much in other people is the thing that we're oftentimes the least willing to give because we're afraid.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. And so then tying that to a phrase I've never heard before that will be a LinkedIn post, I promise you, is managerial courage. Right. And having the courage to say I'm wrong.
Right.
Right. And to admit it, not even be called out on it, maybe even offer it up. Hey, guys, I wanted to share some. I think I got this wrong.
Right.
Right. And to say that to people. And then as a self-described people pleaser, like delivering hard news is not the easiest thing for me. I'm a natural encourager. That's one of my gifts. But the gift taken too far stops being a gift.
Exactly.
And sometimes you have to say, you know, we need to talk about something here.
Yeah.
I don't know if you had the chance yet, but we had one of the founders of Numerator, Jared Schreiber, on, and he was talking about feedback, and he uses this little model of, hey, Chris, you know, I saw, you know, in that presentation, you know, you kind of didn't mention this, which is sort of a key element of our sales presentation to retailers. And just stop. So
that's an awkward silence right there.
but it's just sort of like, I'm going to identify what I saw.
Yeah.
And then now what's very interesting underpinning that model, this is really important, is the assumption of good intent. So I'm not going to berate you for it and say, you know, I've told you 10 times, you know, why aren't you? It's like, you know, and I noticed that you didn't talk about this. Awkward silence, to your point. The person is going to rush to fill that gap because that's human behavior. And you may find out, you know, Bob, I know I didn't do that, but what I had learned earlier was this retailer, like that is a very off strategy thing to say to them. I intentionally didn't say that for this reason. And then you go, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Right. And so all this is sort of tied together. It's very interesting how you're.
It's a great approach because what you're doing is rather than just keep talking, I noticed you didn't do this, and then you should have done that. But filling in with as human nature, we just have to keep talking. Just stop and listen. That awkward sounds to your point, human nature. They'll fill it. They'll either fill it with something that makes sense, and then you're like, okay, good. This person's on top of their business, or they will. Fill it with something that's made up or make it say, hey, my bad, I made a mistake. Either way, they're providing the answer back versus you over coaching. So I love that.
It's a great model. So one of the things I love about doing these is I constantly learning something new. I'm just getting an MBA and, you know, great management practices. Last thing, again, because we're a career club and you're a hiring manager, a team builder. What are the attributes that most get your attention when you're interviewing somebody?
Yeah. So there's a few things. Emotional intelligence is, again, I know it's overused, but it's super important. You got to understand people. That's critical. Resilience, adaptability, because things are always changing. And if they're not changing, you're probably in the wrong space. So you need to be adaptable and embrace that change. I also like a sense of humor because that's just a me thing. I'm not saying like you know, it's a prerequisite to get hired by Chris Hurley, but I do enjoy a sense of humor because we work really hard. A lot of pressure, a lot of stress. Also the opportunity to have a lot of fun. And we're with each other too damn much not to have a few laughs along the way. Yeah. So I enjoy that. Whatever that sense of humor is, you know, bring it. And that I do like that piece. And then also I would say team player, because I think, you know, when people say, what are you most proud of? I've worked for some of the greatest companies that you can have. I've had a wide variety of disciplines that I've been able to work within, but probably the most proud thing is the teams that we've been able to build. And I've been very fortunate to have some good managers show me the way. And I've been very good, fortunate to have some great people work for me and be willing to work for me in a couple of different roles. And that's the most fun. So if you're a team player, again, an overused phrase and a cliche, but by team player, I mean you make the total team better. You support the team, but you also want to pick your teammate up when they need to be picked up, or maybe give them, you know, a little of a nudge if they need a nudge. Because we're all trying to put that perfect puzzle together.
Yes.
And if you got each player fitting their part, complimentary, even with me, I've got many, many opportunities. As I tell my team all the time, and if you surround yourself with people that fill in those gaps, you know, that's how you win. So I mean, emotional intelligence, resilience, hard work, sense of humor, and then making sure that their skill set helps complement your skill set. So you're bringing the best team self to the organization.
Well, yeah, we'll close on that. But what I just want to kind of comment on that is that diversity. You know, back to your kind of thing, like there's a lot of buzzwords floating around these days, and it does become cliche, and you hear a lot about diversity. And one of the things that I have learned from some of the top HR leaders, I think globally, is diversity is the door, but inclusion is really kind of the end game. And so meaning it's one thing to kind of check diversity boxes.
Right.
Like, okay, so we've got, you know, a quota of whatever, but it's inclusion. And the nature of diversity is that you're going to get people that come with different experiences, different strengths, different weaknesses, different life experiences. And so we're not hiring, you know, 11 Chris Hurleys.
Right.
Right. We've got 11 different individuals. And how do we allow people to be the team player that we want them to be and that they want to be?
Right.
By creating an inclusive environment where we actually don't always have to agree. At the end of the day, somebody needs to make a decision.
Right.
Exactly. Right. And maybe not everybody's going to like that. But I think what you're talking about on that last bit is really spot on.
Yeah, we have a very wildly diverse team right now on my team. You know, you talk about quote, checked a lot of those boxes. That's not the intent. That was never the goal. These are just the best people for the job that happened to be hired, that happened to look at them and say, outwardly, that's a diverse team. That's fine. But what it leads to is diversity of thought. So when we're in meetings, you've got people bringing in ideas. And we're representative of our consumers, right? Which is a very diverse population. But at the end of the day, it's about diversity of thought that matters. And often diversity of thought comes with diversity of gender, religion, race, right? That's not by accident. So that's certainly been a big part. But yeah, the team piece is the most fun, most rewarding. And at the end of the day, it's really, I think, what delivers the share price, to be honest.
Awesome. Chris, this has been phenomenal. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it. Both the talking shop part, I learned a few things. And then I always love the second piece of kind of the career advice. And that was just really, really rich stuff. So thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Really appreciate it. Look forward to hearing more from Career Club down the road.
Well, we've got some great episodes coming up, so stay tuned. So everyone, thank you so much for listening. And again, we're very appreciative of Chris Hurley, VP Category Strategy and Shopper Marketing for Pernod Ricard. And look forward to having you join us for another episode. Thanks, everyone. I know.